You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and this week we'll listen to Larry Fader's 120 Minutes, 0 Seconds, a conversation with John Cage, with art by John Cage and a foreword by Tenzin Robert Thurman, which was published in 2012 in Toronto by Nine Point Publishing. This marvelous conversation between Fader and Cage, centered on and around the subject of Zen Buddhism, appeared transcribed in both a trade paperback and in a limited hardback edition, the latter with a CD containing 90 brief tracks that can be shuffled upon playback. We'll listen to them as they were originally laid out on the accompanying CD, which is to say continuously, thereby capturing their conversation as if in real time. Enjoy.
What I was wondering about that story was starting from Kumaraswamy and then eventually going into Zen and Suzuki, in a sense that could be viewed as a preference for Zen.
Oh yes, it's a taste.
It's a taste.
And I could say that you prefer apples to oranges. Mm-hmm. They're all nourishing. That is what Ramakrishna would say, don't you think?
That they're all nourishing?
Well, they all saying the same thing. And he said that all religions are like a lake, and the people are thirsty, and they come from different directions to the lake, and they use different words. But it's essentially, I'm now saying they're all hungry, or you could say that we're all thirsty.
And the Japanese would use the term ine, meaning the teacher that speaks to you.
Yes, yes, yes. There probably have to be different teachings in order to reach the different people. And this kind of information seems implicit in astrology, that there are these different signs and different influences and so on. So that something will be accessible to one that is not to another. I think we notice this on very mundane levels, just among our friends. We notice the differences between people, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Things that make sense to one person make no sense at all to another, or even to the same person. I remember for about 10 years picking up Proust and not being able to read it. And then suddenly when I picked it up, I couldn't let go of it.
I've had the first experience, not the second. Then would you say at this point that your taste is more for Zen?
Yes.
Yes. In that sense, then there might be some real wisdom in what people have been warning Westerners about the East, namely that Western man has a set of tastes, and that whereas I think the ultimate message of the East can certainly be is nobody's soul possession. Still and all, somehow we have to speak to Western man when we're speaking the Eastern truth and have to formulate it in Western terms. Would you agree with that?
I suppose so. I don't know. I guess it's the idea of teaching probably doesn't concern me very much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more interested in persuasion, you know, than teaching.
Uh-huh. I think of the Zen story where the disciple comes to the master and wants to know how to get into Zen. And the master says, well, what do you hear? And the disciple listens and hears a stream. He says, well, I hear a stream. The master says, that's where you begin.
Beautiful.
Then the disciple says, but what if I hadn't heard the stream? The master says, that would be where you begin. in a sense, to to understand Zen.
Yes.
It has to
present. That's very beautiful.
It has to be presented in a way that, starting from what people hear.
Yes. Yeah.
Which may be particular flavors in the West.
The other story about Suzuki and Hawaii philosophers was when they're discussing reality, you know that story. And he remained silent for 3 days, said nothing, and his head was more or less down all the time. And finally the chairman said, "Dr. Suzuki, you haven't said anything about reality." And Suzuki still didn't say anything. And then he said, "Well, would you say this table around which we're sitting is real?" And Suzuki said, "Yes." And the chairman said, "In what sense is it real?" And Suzuki said, "In every sense." Isn't that magnificent?
That's an amazing story. Dick DiMartino tells a beautiful story, too, about one time when Suzuki, I think it was, DiMartino never made the connection, but I think it may have been that same interview with Houston Smith. No, it was an interview with a reporter, and Suzuki was asked, "What is Zen?" And he turned to the reporter and said, "Who asks?" And afterwards, he looked at DiMartino and said, "Just felt like it."
Oh, what a marvelous man. How old was he when he died?
He was just 90 years old.
I have always been saying he was 95 or 96.
No, I'm sorry.
90?
He was 9. Died in 1966.
So
he was 96.
That's what I thought. Isn't that funny? And I saw him very close to that time. I visited him twice in Japan.
Uh-huh.
Once in Kamakura and then twice in Kamakura, and once I saw him in Kyoto.
There's a beautiful picture of the two of you together in one of your books.
I have many more.
Do you? I would love to see them.
I'll show them.
Okay. Somewhere else in your writings, you talk about what it means to study with a teacher, and you talk about studying with Marcel Duchamp means playing chess with him, and studying about mushrooms means being out in the woods with them. Would you say in that sense that you studied with Suzuki?
All I did was to go and sit there while he and with the others, and he would come in and talk to us. And I watched, I was attentive to not only what he said, but how he walked and the expressions on his face. I think I was. And all of that was very beautiful. By beautiful in this case, I mean very instructive. Even though I say I don't like teaching, but it's hard to say one thing or another. But I thought it was beautiful, for instance, that as I've pointed out in my writing, that when the airplanes passed overhead, he didn't pause, even though we couldn't hear a word he was saying. That was very impressive. And another thing that was impressive was that he was sometimes silent at the beginning of the meeting, for up to 10 minutes. And there was no impatience either in us or in him. There was simply a beautiful quietness that you wouldn't even encounter in a Quaker meeting. I've gone to Quaker meetings where they talk about silence, but they never let the silence exist, you know. They're always so anxious to pour out what's inside. And this quietness, which was invariably the beginning of the meeting, was amazing. Then when he would sometimes invite another person to take his place and talk, for instance, he did that, I recall, with a leader of Buddhism from Ceylon. And the man no sooner began talking than Suzuki, who had taken a seat at the side of the table, giving him the center place, which was no more center than any other place. It was just that it was the seat he always had, which he relinquished on this occasion. When he went over to this other seat, he promptly went to sleep. And then when he, at the end, it may have been DiMartino who asked him a question, you know.
The Silanismo? Or
no,
Suzuki?
No, DiMartino, our friend.
Asked.
Suzuki, I think, to say something about, I don't know if this actually happened, but what I've invented in my head is that he said something about what had been happening when he was asleep. And what he said was wrong. You know, it wasn't right to say it. It was irrelevant or something like that. It had nothing to do with the question. It was really quite astonishing. And again, no embarrassment in the situation. No attempt to clear up the situation or place. It was very beautiful, all of that. And then the books wrapped up, you know, and the way you take them out. And then it was clear that, or it seemed to be clear from the way he handled the books and looked at them, and then we decided not to use that one, and that he was preparing what it was he was going to say. I think that Wittgenstein must have taught in a similar fashion. There are reports that he would come before the students and say nothing for the whole period. There would, from time to time, be attempts to speak, but nothing would come out. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't.
He was also a great spiritual leader, it seems to me. When he went to Ireland once, did you never read the memoir by the man who teaches philosophy at Cornell? Memoir of Wittgenstein. It's one of the most beautiful little books. Anyway, when Wittgenstein went on a trip to Ireland, and no one had ever been in his room, so they took a ladder and they put it against the ivy-covered wall and against the window, and they climbed up to see what was in the room. And all there was an army cot. And on the floor next to it was a copy of the Bible. That's all there was.
I know a few people who would not like to hear that. Quite a few.
But that, I think that there is a difference between Wittgenstein's writing and the writing of the followers. One begins to discern it more and more. I mean, more differences. It's probably because no one of them sleeps in an army cot with a copy of the Bible. This is the fact that we've got 100 blinders. It's still alive.
There's a very interesting comment that Peter Yates makes in, it's the book called 20th Century Music, about you. It's kind of biographical. I was wondering if you see any truth in the comment, and that was, he attributes a personal change in you to your study of Zen.
Oh, yes.
You think that there was, in fact, he talks about...
But that was my situation, I was very troubled personally, and I, as people did in the 30s or 40s, maybe they still do, you think of psychoanalysis. And so I... Because of my friendship with Joseph Campbell that I mentioned, and his with Zimmer, and I had met Zimmer, and Zimmer's connection with the Bollingen Press, and the Bollingen Press connection with Jung, rather than Freud, I was sent, or I was introduced to a Jungian psychiatrist who's still practicing. And you know the story that he said he would fix me so that I'd write more music. Oh, do you remember that?
No, I don't remember.
I was already writing so much music that I didn't think that was a very good idea. And I also had all along a kind of chip on my shoulder against psychoanalysis, as Rilke had, because he said, I'm sure you would remove my devils, but I think you might offend my angels. But I did have a Rorschach test taken at the advice of this psychiatrist. And unconventionally, the lady who took the Rorschach test, she was a very good analyst of that kind of thing. She said that I really was very confused, and I was in desperate need of help. And it so happened that everything fitted together. I was simply fortunate. Edith Sarabhai came from India, and I've written about that. She happened to study contemporary music and counterpoint with me. We were often together, practically every day. And then when she left, she gave me the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, which I read. And then that was part of this reading that I've already told you that included the perennial philosophy and Meister Eckhart and Kumaraswamy and then Ramakrishna. And finally, that led me to Zen. What was your question?
Well, what I was leading up to is that it seems as though personal crisis...
Oh, yes. Well, I felt, you see, after all that reading, and then just the moment that I decided that Zen was the flavor that pleased me most, or, you know, seemed most appropriate, just then Suzuki arrived. He began teaching here. It was just as though I had rung a bell, or he had rung a bell or something. And so I was going to his talks before he was connected with Columbia. He spoke in a community, place where Alan Watts did, seems to me, or maybe Alan did later. And then in the religion department of Columbia, and then finally in the philosophy. Oh, and before that, across from the religion in a very big talk. But I was present then all for 3 years. And then, in the course of that, all that reading and listening and so forth, I felt as though the problems with the confusion had dropped away. All along, I haven't wanted to pretend, as I say in the introduction to Silence, I haven't wanted to pretend that I understand everything about Zen, or that I'm enlightened, or anything like that. But I'm at least not as troubled as I was, even if I've made some kind of misinterpretation. I can get around better than I could. This reminds me of at that time that I went to the Naropa Institute. Before the time when I met alone with the Rinpoche, there was a group of poets, including Allen Ginsberg, and all the others who were very clever, about 8 or 9 poets. And we were sitting around the table, and the Rinpoche came in, and the conversation continued, and I had several things to say, mostly to do with poetry and the teaching of it, and how it could be taught in the context of that school. And then they were going on talking, and Rinpoche, he drinks a good deal. Did you know that?
Mm, I've heard that.
He had a huge bottle of sake, and he was continually drinking. And I could see that there was no end to this meeting, absolutely no end. And it was already 1:30 or something like that, and I had a program to give the following day, and rehearsals and everything in the morning. And I said, well, if you'll excuse me, I'll be going. And I went around the table, and he's a kind of a bag of separate pieces of the body, you know, because of that automobile accident. Have you ever seen it? It's almost like a puppet of a shadow play. And he stood up unnecessarily from his chair and embraced me before I left. And then I was told later by one of the poets that after he sat down, the others said, well, shall we run after him and save him? And Rinpoche said, no, he's going to be all right the way he is. he also said a very nice thing to me while we were talking alone together the day after that, 2 days after that. He said that I encouraged him to continue his work.
Rinpoche.
Mm-hmm. In the in the country. Some other Buddhist teacher said that coming to teach in Buddhism in the United States was like teaching to a group of tigers. And something that you said today made me, when you said, do we have to change this to, in order for it to be understandable to Western ears? I don't really think so. I like better that notion of Buckminster Fuller's about the travel going against the wind or with the wind and meeting in America. I think in America you have not only tigers, but you have some very peaceful people too. Don't you think? You have a variety of people.
I guess one of the things that has struck me about the importation of the Orient to the West is that it's imported and transformed into Western terms anyway. For instance, most of what mm-hmm. goes on and is called meditation mm-hmm. is really another form of Western thinking mm-hmm. rather than silence.
Mm-hmm.
And that therefore, perhaps two Western men...
And I really think that the thinking is different because of the language, because our language so much determines what we think. And the... Chinese and Japanese language are very important, it seems to me, in the less so now, but formerly they're so important in that the language was ambiguous, really. As Suzuki would study one of those books, and talk to us, he would say this or this, and it all became something that you actually had to decide yourself, but you could then change your mind and go in another direction. If on another occasion, the language was, so to speak, sculptural, in that it would appear one way from one side and another way from another side. Whereas that isn't characteristic of our Western language.
Do you think that, would you make a distinction between the way we think, which can be then set apart from the way Orientals think?
Well, Chinese and Japanese. I think it's essentially the Chinese and Japanese language that is different than our other languages. I don't think that the Tibetan language has this difference.
Or Sanskrit.
That's what I mean. Or the Indian ones. And Suzuki so often emphasized that Zen only arose because of this fusion of Indian thought with the necessity to translate it into Chinese, you remember. So that it was the Chinese language that's at the crux of Zen. Don't you think?
I think it's the one who thinks. Regardless of the form.
Yeah.
Which is why I think that your question at the end of that introduction to silence is quite apt. Namely, what is American Zen?
Mm-hmm.
is a question that's still left open.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the language of the Western languages and the Sanskritic languages are very different from Chinese and Japanese.
Yes.
Nevertheless, what is thought is the same. I think it's the one who thinks, regardless of the form.
Yeah.
Which is why I think that your question at the end of that introduction to silence is quite apt. Namely, what is American Zen?
Mm-hmm.
is a question that's still left open.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the language of the Western languages and the Sanskritic languages are very different from Chinese and Japanese.
Yes.
Nevertheless, what is thought is the same.
Yes, and finally we come back, it seems to me, to Ramakrishna's lake. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the language makes it, facilitates getting to the lake, and sometimes it's an impediment to get it.
Okay. For a Western man, I would say that to begin with a rational discourse may be precisely the thing that's needed in order to go to that non-rational or irrational state.
I've written a story of a lady in the past said to Suzuki that she was having trouble with Meister Eckhart because of all the Christian symbolism. He said, oh, that'll disappear, that trouble.
And yet his beginning was a very Western expression, in the sense of the essence of Eastern truth.
Oh, do you have the Lao Tzu that he helped to translate?
With Paul Karras?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Could you... I don't think I have it. I wanted a Xerox of it.
I'll be happy to send you.
Would you?
I have our college library's copy, but I'd be happy to send you a copy.
I may have it, in which case you don't have to do it, but I keep... Well, I should be able to find it now. I'll ask Bruce.
It's a very difficult book to locate.
Very. I had run across it once, and it left such a beautiful impression. And I thought when I ran across it that it would be easy to run across it again. And then years later when I wanted to, I've gone to libraries countless times looking for it. Very difficult to find.
Another difficult thing to find on Taoism, but maybe one of the most astute and dead center commentaries, is the introduction that Suzuki did to the Lega two-volume Texts of Taoism.
Oh, I'd love to read that.
Oh, that's an amazing piece.
Uh-huh.
I'll send you a copy of that.
Would too. You please?
Sure. I'd be happy to.
I just received another text while I was on one of these trips. I have to sort of save myself from papers. They so spontaneously
regenerate.
Oh, here it is. Yeah. The Buddha's Law Among the Birds.
I don't know.
You know this one?
Oh, what's up?
I was just giving this recently. Then do you have that? I have many copies of I think I have it right here. It's a text that was made available very cheaply to people at Naropa. Here it is. So I had a number made and I wanted to give them away. Do you want this one? The third set.
I have no idea.
So that's for you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
If you want, if you don't know this, you want to take it and then send it back to me. That would be all right. Because I'm so busy now, I wouldn't be able to get to it. Right?
Okay. I'll send this with you, guys.
Thank you.
There's a nice anecdote in another one of your books about a friend who is mentioning that if you would give a lecture now, you wouldn't give a lecture in Zen Buddhism. And you respond to that by saying that the friend thought that you were window shopping, and that in fact, if there's to be any global village whatsoever, Zen would have to be the essence of that. Still think that way?
Oh, yes.
And you put it in terms of...
I've been shocked, really, by that window shopping attitude. But that's... I think that's when one encounters Zen, but not with an awareness of being in a desperate circumstance. Mm-hmm. I think it's unless one realizes that the situation is desperate, that not just Zen, but anything, nothing really reaches. That must surely be why it is important to be, you know, desperately important to eat well.
Yeah. I think you were saying something like that this afternoon as I was eating a hamburger. Very true. If this desperateness or being, I guess, in a Zen image, hanging by your teeth from a limb over a bottomless pit, is necessary for Zen, then how do you come to teach or to express music, which is essentially in order to quiet the mind, when you're dealing with people who don't realize that they're in that crisis situation?
Mm. What is your question?
When composing for people who aren't in that crisis, who don't know ultimate crisis, the ultimate contradiction of self, if the goal of
your question is mistaken. You say when you are composing for these people, that's not what's being done, because we don't know who those people are who are going to be listening. And though you have described them, you've connected them with my activity here, and that connection already makes an erroneous question. The question doesn't make sense to anybody.
I see your point. Then,
I mean, when the set, it's like an if question. And here I am doing my work, and I've pointed out that posing is one thing, and performing is a second, and listening is a third. And when I'm doing this, this is what I'm doing. When people are listening, that's another situation. And then we have that complex thing that astrology represents. Mm-hmm. And some people won't be able to hear it. Certainly President Ford, it wouldn't make any effect upon it.
Mm-hmm. Richard Nixon may have been more in line. Maybe very open at this point.
Whereas there are other circumstances where people say their hair could stand on end, not even hearing it, but just hearing about it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes. Well, then let's
I don't see that we mustn't make simple cause and effect questions.
Then let's keep it within the realm of composing. Composition is to quiet the mind.
Mm-hmm. Then it's my discipline.
It's your discipline.
So that my... and unfortunately, I don't think that is well enough understood about my work. But that's what it essentially is.
It's your mantra.
It's how I spend my life, and it's what... I think it's what keeps me open rather than closed to the world, whether outside or inside. I think that's what it is. And the reason I keep using that image is because it came to me from Suzuki. It was one of those remarkable moments when everything he was saying seemed crystal clear, you know. Rather than as it so often did, just muddy, and unclear. I remember days hearing him talk that I couldn't make any sense of it. But this other day, it was very clear. He drew this oval shape, and he said, "This is the structure of the mind." And he drew two parallel lines on one side. He said, "This is the ego." He said, "It has the capacity to close itself off from its experience, whether it comes from outside through the senses or from inside through the dreams." And he said the experience is actually full circle. Mm-hmm. And what Zen wants is that the ego not act as a barrier, but that it become open so that it can go out or in and go all the way around.
Can it do that and still be itself?
How do you do it without
itself?
It wouldn't be able to. But it explains, for instance, the remark of Rilke in front of a tree. He said, which is which? Am I the tree or is the tree? He felt such a sense of identification. In other words, he was out there with the tree.
Or Suzuki's comparison of the flower in the granite wall, which is plucked, or which one immediately sees oneself in. Then,
so that when you're here writing, say I was to concern myself at this point with the people who were going to be hearing me, I would then be...
It's impossible to have a quiet mind.
In that confused state of mind that made my Rorschach test so poor.
Is it ever possible to have a quiet mind?
What?
Is it ever possible to have a quiet mind?
I shouldn't think so, but I don't know whether I'm the one you should ask.
I suppose being theoretical about it, if there was a quiet mind, would there then be composition?
Doesn't seem to be a quiet world, so I shouldn't think it'd be quiet. If it were a quiet mind, it seems to me it would not be paying attention to its environment. Because it doesn't matter which sense you speak of, but there's continually something happening to see or to hear. I keep thinking that taste and smell and touch are not such constant experiences as seeing and hearing. Actually, people write to me more and more, and I think among the young people there's the great, great importance placed on those other senses, or on those people. But I think the classical and sort of time-honored senses are those of seeing and hearing. Don't you?
In terms of survival,
well, no, and the whole thing of history and language and culture of shared experience and so on and so forth, it all goes through those senses rather than the others. The experiences of touch and taste, smell are so localized and so even difficult to describe. Don't you think?
Thinking about it.
It's very, very strange, and yet there's an increasing interest in that.
What does it have to do with the desire to experience things without having all the information? Seems to be.
Have you, this is changing a little bit, did you ever hear of that conversation, or not conversation, it was a talk to me by Suzuki on the subject of bells?
No.
No. I visited him in Kamakura, and I've suspected since then that though I expressed the desire to visit him, that the people who were sponsoring the tour, who were a flower arrangement school in Tokyo, the Sogetsu, that they not only had me encouraged and arranged the visit with Suzuki, but that they may even have thought of it as a publicity stunt. And that I don't know what they did, or whether they might even have paid him to, to. At any rate, he gave a lovely talk on the subject of bells. And photographing is actually of me listening to him talking about bells. And he said that the Western bell goes out, you know, this way, and the beater is inside, but the our yellow bell comes in, and the beater is outside. And then he said something about the beater, which is outside, makes a sound which goes in, you know, and that he claimed that the Western bell is, you know, a sound that goes brilliantly out.
Getting back to the notion of Zen as the basis for an ethical global village, in that same response, the window shopping, you mentioned that we have to do away with our likes and dislikes. How do you relate those likes and dislikes to the natural taste likes and dislikes that you admit?
Oh, one can have for himself likes and dislikes. And can recognize them. What I think is harmful about likes and dislikes is when you then impose them on other people.
So it's the externalization that's the problem?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Mm-hmm. For instance, say someone decided that he actually liked to eat chicken, but didn't like to eat beef. Then say he became President Ford and made a law that no one could eat beef. That, of course, is an obvious mistake. If one's going to be eating these things.
In that instance, you might better move to India. There's no problem at all. So then there can be the discrimination and yet non-externalization of it.
I should think so. At the same time that again an instance within the it's internal, so to speak. Say you want a chicken, but you go to the store and there isn't any. Mm-hmm. Then to have the ability to use what there is, rather than the things that won't burn. Rather than going on eating the chicken which isn't available.
In order to do that, you would have to also
be free. I would say that is what Suzuki meant when he said the feet are a little off the ground.
Would you apply that also to your own music? For instance, if no idea came, which was non-discriminatory between noise, silence, music, would you then write a piece of music which maybe harmonic, conventional in the romantic sense?
I haven't quite understood that ability to be one or the other there, though it's very interesting.
Well, if we draw a parallel to the grocery shopper who can't find any chicken and therefore should be free enough to have beef, supposing that no idea came, that was non-discriminatory in terms of noise, silence, and sound, music, to you. Would you then be free to write a piece that sounded like Mahler, or that used the beef rather than the chicken?
I see. There circumstances have arisen in the past, and now they're arising again, where things that I've had a distinct distaste for have come into my music. It's largely through circumstances. and the willingness to meet them. And at the present moment, the one you speak of, harmony is creeping in.
It's going to make the Boston Symphony Orchestra happy.
Yeah, and Beethoven, of course, got into harpsichord and also into the Williams. And radio music, and so on. Those are the various things. I think that specific use of something that has been distasteful, in my case, has only happened in the way that I described. I'm more apt to write something, the outcome of which I don't foresee at all, so that the outcome wouldn't tend to go into some known formula or known category of, say, harmony or not harmony. It'd be more like something we hadn't heard. We would tend to think that the way that harmony is the creeping in here is that it's a bicentennial piece. And I found through the copyright problems, as I had before, that even that old music of the 18th century is copyright now because everyone sees an opportunity to make money. On 17th century, it's like bunnies. Made difficult problems, if not financially, they've done it often pseudo-spiritual ideas about the church music of the past. The Moravian church, for instance, won't permit me to use any of the Moravian music because they think I'm intentions of sacrilegious.
Very quickly, are they?
So anyway, and on top of that, there is this idea that an artist has something to say. So that, Seiji Ozawa, who asked me to write the piece, wants to know what I have to say about all that old music.
Uh-huh.
And I'm writing, the piece I'm writing is this Renga, which is the Japanese link poetry, with Apartment House 1776. And the result is I'm going to imitate all that old music, rather than copy it. My inclination as a follower of Duchamp would be to just copy it, you know, sign it. But the laws are so strict in music still. I mean, all the things that were done just automatically in pendulum are still not permitted legally.
The honesty in that passage that we were talking about before is quite a testimony. And especially when you start talking about Germany and your dislike for Germans, I wonder if freedom in that sense that you seem to be moving towards or really grappling with in an essential way wouldn't be defined from a Zen perspective as the freedom to like a romantic piece as well as an anti-romantic. It would be non-romantic rather than anti-romantic.
Well, I still have, am inclined to say in response to that, let's not go too far.
Could you talk a little bit about the notion of, in one of your lectures, silence demanding that we speak?
That's actually the lecture on nothing, I believe. And that the subject, of course, called for that statement. What else could I say?
Nothing. For instance, do you know Shinichi Hisamatsu?
I think I do. Is he an esthetician?
Yes.
I think I met him. And he was the one who said to me, when I told him that I was interested in the ears, don't you remember? And he said, oh, you must remember that you hear with your feet also.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm? Yes. Would that be he?
That would be the one. A few others could. descend and hear a defeat.
And then I had an experience later in which I heard, so to speak, of my whole body. I may be very literal, but that's my tendency. I was in England in a large room where it was possible to hear low sounds at high amplitude. It was connected with architectural studies and noises. But when I heard I could do this, I asked them to make the volume, increase it as I would make a gesture. They didn't want to be in the room with me, but they looked through the window at me. And I kept asking for it to be louder until finally it was a massage.
I had a similar experience once, sitting with my back to a window and listening to music.
Yes.
And hearing the bass with
yes.
my hands.
Yes. Actually, and once you've heard it, then you are, so to speak, open to that on many more occasions. It's the same as with mushrooms. Mushrooms, which once you know about them, become visible, you know. Mm. Where another person who doesn't know about them sees nothing to walk through the sand.
Hisamatsu's category of nothingness, in an article called Oriental Nothingness, demands in a very Zen-like way that true nothingness is never a nothing that stands opposed to something. It is always a nothing prior to something and nothing. And that makes a demand that it be expressed.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about the fundamental subject, which is nothing, expressing itself.
Also, it's an openness to the, well, to the fact of experience.
Total openness.
Yeah.
Being nothing, therefore being total.
I can imagine, I think we frequently force ourselves to not pay attention. And I should think that that would be one of the first things that a conventional student, say of Zen, would attempt to do, would be to make his mind a blank, don't you think?
To attempt it.
And to absolutely not notice anything that's happening. And that's probably why they get hit over the head. Because they can't ignore it at that point.
That may be a drawing of what you're talking about. I understand.
Yeah.
So that kind of nothingness not only demands expression, but whatever it is, expresses itself
right.
naturally.
Yeah.
It's a very different kind of nothing from something.
Yeah.
Is that the nothingness that you're hinting at in, or that you're expressing in your essay on nothing?
Well, again, I know what more I want to answer that than to answer so many questions.
Okay. Did I get you in there? Could we talk a little bit about the notion, in along the same vein, it all boils down to the same question, of continuity and discontinuity? Because here, we can look at the Oriental tradition of art, in which case you have tremendously long and continuous expression of discontinuity, and to look at your own music, in which case it's constantly doing that. I don't think they're necessarily opposed, but could you expand on the difference between them or lack of it?
The discontinuity of what?
Well, let's say no drama, which is all very proper. The form is maintained in an incredibly precise way from generation to generation. That's a continuity, and yet when you pierce to the essence of no, what it does is cut off any continuity with any historical context or any personal context or whatever. It puts you right in the moment. In a sense, I feel your music is doing the same, and yet it's doing it without allowing for the continuity. It's discontinuous continuity, in a sense.
Well, I've written a great deal of music, and the from the beginning, if you look at my very early music, or from a conventional point of view, you find it stopping. It no sooner gets started than it stops. And one of my teachers used to complain, so why do you put these silences in when the music has just barely begun? He said you shouldn't have that until the end. You should, once you get started, you should keep on going to the end. And then again, as a 12-year-old in high school, I wrote a speech about Latin American relations in the United States, and I suggested that our industry should be silent in order that we could hear that other people were thinking and what they were thinking. So that you could say I was prepared for later studying Zen. After studying Schoenberg, the reason I studied with Schoenberg was because I had devised a way of writing music, a method of writing it that made let all the sounds appear before they reappeared. And that resembled his 12-tone brother composer, and that was why I studied it. But when it became clear to both of us that I had no feeling for harmony, and I was attracted to sounds, noises, and so forth outside the field of harmony, I then felt, fresh from Schoenberg, that I needed some kind of structure to let different kinds of sounds than ones that were tonal or harmonious, a structure in which they would have a place. And so, as I've told, I found that it should be a structure of time that is as hospitable to noise as it was to sound. And I think at that point, when I was using rhythmic structures, that there could have been a similar, the music that I would have written could have been similar, let us say, to No Drama. However, in that music, which has a rhythmic structure, I tended to continue the Western notion that music was, that sounds were doing something or saying something or fulfilling some function with respect to a whole and so forth, so that there was a kind of continuity of the sounds in the early pieces in the late 30s and 40s up through the, say, the sonatas and interludes or even the string quartet, where you don't get a sense of discontinuity. Though a discontinuity in those rhythmic structures, as I am repeating now, would be like the experience one has from No. Maybe the closest that comes to that is a piece called them, because there's now a transition between not having structure and having structure, and between the music having activity that is like discourse or doing something, and then the later music where nothing of that is being done, and where furthermore there isn't any structure. Well, in between those two, there is a structure, but there's the at least diminution of doing something. So that it, and that comes through the use of the I Ching and the chance operations, and the pieces are, to be specific, the music of changes, two pastorals, the imaginary landscape number 4 for 12 radio,